4. Creature Feature Comforts. Arbor Hill, Albany, New York, June 7th, 2028. There's a game that they play, Allison Nicodemo and the psychiatrist. She tells him a lie, and he patiently makes like he doesn't know that she's lying, no matter how outrageously, how egregiously the lie contradicts some previous lie that she's already passed off as the truth. They have arrived at the simple rules of the game by a silent, unspoken gentleman's agreement. It's true no one will ever win, at least not fair and square. But, she tells herself, whenever she feels up to pretending there's a bright side, the most she'll ever lose is 1 hour every 2 weeks, and, after all, she's got time to burn. If time were money, Allison Nicodemo would be Scrooge McDuck. She can afford the pantomime. Exempli gratia. It's 2:05 on a Monday afternoon, and Allison sits on the wide, slightly threadbare corduroy sofa in the psychiatrist's office, wishing, just like always, that she could get by without the charity of the agency's stingy pension. If she could only manage that trick somehow, then she'd be free to tell the psychiatrist enough was enough, and his services were no longer required, thank you very goddamn much. That he could take his kindly knowing looks and patronizing nods and go fuck himself. Game, set, match. Checkmate. She could stand up and walk out the door for the last and final time and catch a bus back across town. She could score and fix and, as she nodded off in a velvety heroine fog, she could congratulate herself on finally finding the backbone to do what she should have done a long damn time ago. Of course, she knows she won't. She was never a particularly brave woman, even at her best. And at 41, Allison knows that her best is far behind her. Her best is dead and buried. Still, there are days when the fantasy that she might is the only thing that gets her from one excruciating side of these sessions to the other. The clock ticks. Here we go again. How are you doing today? The psychiatrist stops staring at the screen of his iPad and stares at Allison instead. The man is at least old enough to be her father. He has great bushy eyebrows that remind her of Gandalf or Walt Whitman. She's wondered if maybe he's one of the shrinks who worked on MK Ultra or the Stargate Project or some other long-ago covert psycho-fuck operation, or if maybe he has no idea whatsoever who actually writes his checks. Maybe he's exactly who the diplomas on the wall say he is, and no more. Maybe he's no one much at all. Possibly he's the single least interesting man Allison Nicodemo has ever met, and the most subversive thing the psychiatrist ever did was vote for Goldwater in 1972. But it's got to be one or the other. Either he's an agency man following a carefully prepared script, minding protocol to the letter, or he's a patsy who really does believe she isn't anything more exciting than a junkie and a profoundly delusional schizophrenic who only thinks she used to be some sort of top-secret occult assassin for a shadow government, and he only plays the game because the checks don't bounce. He can't be both or anything in between. Albany has never been one for half measures. In for a penny, in for a pound. Last time, he says, you told me that today maybe we could talk about Atlanta and the scars. Are you still up for that? I understand it's a big step. Allison shuts her eyes a moment and tries to recall if she really did say that 2 weeks back, or if he's just banking on there being so little left of her short-term memory that she's not in a position to argue the point. Did I? She asks, opening her eyes again. On the wall behind the psychiatrist, there's a cheaply framed print, a copy of an oil painting of a rocky seashore someplace like Rhode Island or Maine or Massachusetts. Or Wales, she thinks, and not for the first time. Well, if I did tell you that, I shouldn't have. If I did say that, I've changed my mind. The psychiatrist frowns his consternation and rubs at his bushy white eyebrows. Are you sure? He asks her, and she tells him yeah, she's sure. In fact, she's very, very sure. All right, then. What would you prefer we talk about today? He asks. What about your sister? We never did quite finish with that, did we? Ellison almost asks which story about her sister he means, which fabricated version of the truth it is that the psychiatrist would like her to continue with. And, by the way, for the record, she never actually had a sister. And the psychiatrist knows that. Only an older brother whom she never even met because he died of a fever when he was just a baby. But she doesn't ask. Asking would almost certainly violate the rules of the game, whatever those might be. When I was a kid, I got a pet monster, Ellison says, before she can think better of it, before it occurs to her this is the worst imaginable way of cheating, because, as it happens, she's telling the truth. The psychiatrist stops rubbing his eyebrows and clears his throat. A monster, he says, not in a way that dares to sound as if he doubts what she's told him, but only as if to suggest that maybe he wasn't paying close attention, or perhaps the noise of a delivery truck rattling past down on Livingston Avenue made it hard for him to hear what she said. Yeah, she says, astounded at her own audacity and wishing she had a cigarette, wishing the psychiatrist would let her smoke in his office. Well, I didn't really think of it as a monster, not when I was little. The psychiatrist opens the bottle of water on his desk and takes a swallow. Then he clears his throat again. You mean like an imaginary friend? He asks her, and to Ellison it almost seems as if he's asking hopefully. No, I mean like a monster, she says. It wasn't imaginary, and I never thought of it as especially friendly either. Though every now and then it was sort of helpful. Sort of helpful, says the psychiatrist, and then he taps at his pad before screwing the cap back on the water bottle and setting it aside. Helpful how, exactly? Like, sometimes it would show up when I was in trouble. If it was helpful, why do you call it a monster? The psychiatrist wants to know. Ellison sits up a little straighter, and she glances at the window and the dingy beige drapes hiding the view of the world outside. Her mouth has gone a little cottony, and right now she wouldn't mind if the psychiatrist deigned to offer her a sip of his water. She says, It seems to me that the world is full of helpful monsters. I don't necessarily see a contradiction between monstrosity and usefulness. Some of the most terrible things, the most hideous things, we let them into our lives, knowing full well that they're monsters, because they're helpful. She expects the psychiatrist to ask her to pony up an example, but he doesn't. If he had, she might have said nuclear fission, or she might have said religion, or she might have said something else altogether. She might even have said psychiatry, only she isn't so sure if it's of much use to anyone. I see, says the psychiatrist. Do you? Ellison asks, still watching the drapes. When she arrived for her appointment almost 45 minutes ago, she's usually early. The sky was hidden behind a blanket of blue-gray clouds, much as the drapes now hide her view of Arbor Hill. The air had smelled of ozone and the promise of rain. She'll probably get soaked on the way home, bus or no bus. Now the psychiatrist is looking at the drapes too, as if he's afraid he's missing something, as if there might be something here he ought to see, but doesn't. He says, What I mean is, I understand the point that you're making about the occasional usefulness of things most people would find monstrous. A lot of people wouldn't understand, she tells him, then looks away from the window, looking back at the psychiatrist and the framed seashore. Or I don't know, maybe they would, if they ever had a reason to stop and think about it. For a few seconds, neither of them speaks, and then the psychiatrist asks her, How old were you the first time you saw this monster? It's not too late to make a bad joke of the whole thing, Ellison thinks. It's not too late to go back to lying and chalk it up to being in a worse mood than usual. He'd believe that. But then she reminds herself that the psychiatrist probably doesn't live in a universe that permits the existence of monsters. Not real monsters, anyway. And besides, by the unspoken rules of their game, everything she tells him is a lie, every confidence a deception. So it really doesn't much matter what she says. I was almost 11 years old. No, wait, that's not right. I was already 12. I'd already started junior high school. I was in 6th grade the first time I saw the hound. The hound? He asks her. So the monster was a dog? No, she replies. No, it wasn't. It really wasn't anything like a dog. But I always thought of it as the hound, right from the beginning. Don't ask me why, because I don't know. I didn't know then, and I don't know now. But I had to think of it as something, you know. And I guess thinking of it as a hound was a lot easier to deal with than acknowledging that it was a monster. She expects the psychiatrist to make a note of that, but he doesn't. He just watches her instead. See, now he's sitting there waiting to hear a proper story. His favorite lunatic has whetted his appetite, and now he wants to know some more. He wants a ripping good yarn. Now he's got a rock-solid hard-on for a scary story from a crazy lady, a story that he can diagnose and dismiss and make not the least bit scary at all. Here in this office, be no monsters whatsoever. Have another few pills, Miss Nicodemo. You'll feel better in a day or two, and it's all covered by your insurance, naturally. We've talked about how my stepfather beat my mom, she says, and now she keeps her eyes on the painting on the wall behind the psychiatrist. Allison hates the painting because of all the awful things it dredges up. Jehoshiba, and the shark, and all the rest. But even those horrors, a danse macabre, to put Edgar Allan Poe and all his ilk to shame, are somehow easier to face than what she's about to tell the old man with the bushy white eyebrows. Yes, says the psychiatrist. Yes, we have. And I told you that he finally stopped? I told you that he stopped after that time he beat her so badly that he put her in the hospital with broken ribs and a concussion. You did, the psychiatrist nods. Well, that wasn't the truth. He didn't stop hitting your mother? No, he stopped. But that isn't why he stopped. He stopped after the first time the hound came. It was a Friday or Saturday night. I'm not sure which, but I remember I was up late because I didn't have school the next day, and my stepfather came in drunk. My mother said something to him. I don't remember that either, just what it was she said, but it doesn't matter. Probably something she should have known was gonna set him off. I imagine by then she didn't much care anymore. By then, she probably knew she'd get hit no matter what she did or didn't say. Anyway, she said it, and he knocked her down. We were in the living room. I was on the floor in front of the TV, and when he hit her, she stumbled backwards and tripped over the coffee table. Mom landed right next to me. Her lip was bleeding. She lay there, staring up at him, sort of smiling, like she was daring him to keep it up. She didn't even look at me. It's almost like I wasn't there. Allison is quiet for a moment, concentrating on the painting of the sea, the waves battering that rocky shore, the white cottage that seems as if it's about to be swallowed up by the tide, shivered and dashed apart and washed away. It's fine if you'd like to stop here for now, says the psychiatrist, but she knows he doesn't mean it. And even if he does, she's gone too far to turn back. And wasn't that always the way of it? Isn't that something the signalman said to her once, ages and ages ago? That she had a way of getting in too deep, too fast, like she was afraid if she didn't jump in both feet first, she might never jump in at all. It's okay, she says. I'm fine. Then continue, says the psychiatrist, as if Allison needs his permission. She was lying there, and he was standing over her, and I sort of think he really meant to kill her that time. And so maybe he'd have had to kill me too, because I would have seen him do it, and my stepfather was terrified of going to prison. His own dad had... Never mind, that's a different story. There was my mom, and there was I, and suddenly I heard this sound, and I smelled something like... Well, to tell you the truth, it wasn't like anything I'd ever smelled in my life, but it was a cold sort of smell, you know? That night, sitting there on the floor waiting for him to kill her, I thought how it was a smell that could have only come from someplace very cold, like Antarctica or outer space or the bottom of the sea. Someplace like that. And then the hound was there, standing over my mom. It was big. I mean, fucking huge. One minute it hadn't been there, the next it was. But I thought maybe it had come in through an open window, and I was so scared I just hadn't noticed. The hound? Asked the psychiatrist. Yeah, says Ellison. The hound. But it didn't look like a hound. Not even a little bit, she tells him, not taking her eyes off the painting. Back in 2005, when the agency headhunter recruited me, they already knew about the hound. That's why they recruited me. But still, they'd never seen it for themselves. They would later on, soon enough, but they hadn't yet that day. Anyway, I honestly tried to describe it for them, until I realized that I might as well have been trying to describe the color pink to Stevie Wonder.
But that night, your stepfather saw it, and your mother.
Allison nods. Yeah, he shit himself. I mean, he literally shit his pants. And then he ran away, and we never saw the son of a bitch again. He didn't even call or come back for his stuff or anything. He was just gone. And Allison snaps her fingers for extra added emphasis. Mom, she lay there on the floor, and she didn't really look scared. Me, on the other hand, I was plenty buku scared, because I figured this thing, this monster that had jumped in through the window and frightened off my drunken stepfather, was about to devour the both of us. The psychiatrist scratches his eyebrows. But it didn't, he says. Well, obviously, says Allison, wishing he'd stop interrupting and let her finish. It looked down at Mom, and then it sort of looked over at me. And I say it looked, but that's only because I don't know how to explain what it really did. And then it vanished again, leaving behind that cold smell and these smears of blue slime where it had been standing. It would take Mom days to scrub that stuff up off the floor, and even then there would always be a stain. Anyway, that night I crawled over to her and we sat there a real long time holding each other and crying, waiting for my stepfather to show up again and kill us, or for the monster to reappear and eat us. I think we must have sat there almost until dawn. And that was the very first time I saw my monster, the hound. Allison stops staring at the painting and allows herself to look at the psychiatrist again. He doesn't seem nearly as surprised as she might have expected, but he also doesn't look as if he buys a word she said. Why would he? He knows the rules of the game. This is a true story. Every word I say is a lie. It's okay, she says. I wouldn't believe me either. I didn't say that I don't believe you. The psychiatrist tells her, and then the clock on the wall above the office door ticks especially loud, and Ellison glances up to see that it's only 5 minutes after two. How are you doing today? The psychiatrist wants to know, and he swipes two fingers across his pad and clears his throat. Before she answers, he asks, Are you about ready to begin? She squeezes her eyes shut, and she imagines she hears the signalman. Your move, kiddo. We don't have all day. Not much point belaboring strategies. You know perfectly damn well you're too cowardly to even attempt. Sure, Ellison Nicodemo tells a psychiatrist, and she opens her eyes, and the game begins again.